Well, here we are. With some new faces. Ron is here from Floating Zendo. Very nice to see you. And there she is, Rhea is here from New Mexico. It's where we've known each other for years and years and years. Welcome. Glad you could come. And your name, I've forgotten. Yeah. You never told me. Oh, I thought you did.
Ivan.
Oh, it's wonderful that you're here. This is a wonderful, large group, larger than we're used to sitting at this session. And that it's so hot is traditional. So don't mind. It's just the way it is. I remember at Hidden Villa so many times when we had our early sessions with Coben, and we would sit in a heap like this, and when we'd stand up, there would be puddles of water on the zabutons where we had just been losing our juice. So we're losing our juice, even if it doesn't make a puddle. And I want to encourage everyone to stay hydrated. Means drink lots of water, because it's really important. I spent a lot of time in the Southwest this summer, and it was really hot there, unbelievably. In Las Cruces, down in the middle of the desert, stark, stark desert with black, steep mountains sort of in the background. And it would be 105, 104, 105 every day. And it was a wedding, so the bride was all dressed in this beautiful white gown. And all the bridesmaids were on beautiful gowns. And when people came, instead of offering wine, we were offered water. You know, be sure you have some water, it said. So I'm especially alert to that. And salt also. We're losing salt, and we need to replace it. That's what keeps the whole system going, actually, though we are always persuaded to not take salt. But not enough salt can make us sick also. So I want to talk about the body, which is what I usually do on the first day. And usually on the first day, we are so self-concerned, just trying to organize ourselves and get ourselves persuaded to sit and to figure out how we're going to sleep and if it's going to be okay and all of those things. And then I sort of remind us that, don't forget, sitting is about being a body. But I think today we're terribly aware of it. We are feeling a bit stressed physically. It's hard. It's hard to be hot. And it's, if we use it well, it can keep us embodied in a way that's extremely important, really, all the time. We're now in a culture where people are walking off of curbs and into light posts because they're so distracted by what they're reading and looking at. We become more and more disembodied in our culture. And so in practicing Zen, the first emphasis, and the last as well, is to not only remember, but take care of this whole process that we call mind-body, or body-mind. It's inseparable, although the only way we can talk about it is with two words. I hope sometime we'll invent a whole new vocabulary for how we are, because it's very awkward, this split that keeps happening, and it encourages the split in our mind as well. But mind-body and body-mind is one process. It isn't exactly a thing. You can't call it a thing. It's a life. So I do want to encourage you to give yourself the best posture. And as I look around the room, I see that you do. You all have fine posture, really fine. So keep it up. No, I'll try to, too. It's not easy. And as the week goes by, you'll find some ways that you're much stronger, your back gets stronger, and other ways when you become weary. And as Koban always said, our feeling about pain, really the surprise that comes to us when we see how much pain we're in, is just that we don't notice it during our everyday life. We deal with it. We take a walk, and when our feet start to hurt, we stop and go back. If we are carrying ourselves in a sort of a thoughtless way, even in our sleep, we turn. And if we are sleepless, we begin to notice why we turn, and we do the turn because something begins to ache and we have to change and shift. And here we're asking our body not to change and shift. So the body itself is shocked, usually. It's very surprised to be asked to do this very unusual and extremely difficult and uncomfortable thing. And so we need to be very kind to it and nurture it as best we can. In the early days when we were sitting, as Jerry probably remembers well, and Cliff too, how hard we sat, how intense we were, how rigid we were, and how many hurts we got as a result of it. So I think in the meantime, we've learned something from that, and don't feel compelled to make a sort of issue out of being extremely proper and immobile. We keep on moving, whether we think we're still or not. We're always moving. Our blood is flowing, and our lymph is flowing, and our breath is flowing, and actually all of our cells are flowing as well. We're one little bundle of activity. We just don't notice it. So as you sit, you can begin to realize that your toes are breathing and your ears are breathing, that the whole system is breathing, and it's breathing with everyone. We're all doing this breath together with the trees and the grass, the birds. So sitting like this, although it's painful, is a great lesson in humility, one, and two, in how completely connected we are with everything else. We can't deny it anymore. Our situation is so peculiar. It's really very almost inconceivable that we can be one and yet many. And again, we need a piece of language that could express that, because we can't really say it very well. Or as they say in Zen, not one, not two. Which leaves the whole thing sort of open. Which is the way it is. It's sort of open. So the first thing we know about Zazen is that it's a body thing. And that it requires some attention. And not much more. Koban always used to say that our biggest effort in Zazen is just to try not to fall off the cushion. Doesn't sound very romantic or very fun, does it? It's just, you know, we're not going to get enlightened, we're not going to go to some blissful place, we're just going to try to not fall off the cushion. Which means try to stay here. Be here. Be what it is. Not a dream. But of course, the dream is us too. So it's not a matter of eradicating anything, but accepting it as it comes and goes. And as I always try to remember, because Koban always insisted on it, is a little smile. Although we never do it, or it's very hard to do, because our feeling about this practice is so serious, and rightly so. But the mind begins to crunch down as we sit, and we tend to naturally go toward the negative as we think. And so there's a physical response in the brain to a smile, which changes the mood. It uplifts the mood. So it doesn't have to be a big smile, but a small smile, you will find, will lighten your mind and lighten your breath and make sitting a lot easier. Another thing that makes it easier is to make sure that your ears are lined up with your shoulders. This is something I never accomplished for years and years. I guess because I read so much and write so much, I'm always hunched over. And when I finally began to sit with my head back, my shoulders dropped. I thought, oh, what they say is true. What they say is true. So if you find that your shoulders are getting very tense, make sure that you've tucked your chin and that your head is back. Your head is so heavy, you don't want your shoulders to have to hold the whole thing. So give them a break and then they'll fall down. And we're doing the cosmic mudra, this place where mind and body unite in our hands, both sides of the body. It rests against our belly, so that this place is where in terms of the body, it's a nodule of intelligence, you could say, that they're just discovering. This is a nodule of intelligence also, that they didn't know about before, although yogis have been talking about it for millennia. So we're not doing this just because it's a fancy kind of esoteric thing to do. But this is actually connecting with the power of the life of the body-mind. So if we're able to make this connection just very lightly, it's extremely light, and rest against the body, the belly, and just then the belly goes in and out as you breathe, and you begin to feel you're a receiving and ascending system at this point. It's all coming in and going out. You yourself are, in some sense, the world, your world. And this is an expression of it. Sometimes people can't do this. Sometimes it's too powerful. And then Koban always suggested holding the right thumb with the left hand and just wrapping them around and making a kind of nut out of your hands together like this. And sometimes that feels very nice. Sometimes you don't feel like receiving and sending. You just are surviving. So this is fine too. This just brings us down to where we are. When Buddha sat, he sat as a body under a real tree on the ground. So originally, from the very beginning, our practice is a body-mind grounded practice. One of my favorite poems is, "My body, my love, my horse, my hound, what will you be when I am gone?" It's, I think it's Muriel Rukeyser. That's not the whole poem at all, that's the part I remember. It's not exactly an animal that we're riding, it's, and yet it feels that way. And as we get more intimate with our body, we begin to see how fragile it is and how temporary. Whatever age we are, we really don't know what the next step is going to be. So the preciousness of it becomes more clear. The more aware we are as a physical being, the more poignant our life becomes, because it's so fragile and so sweet at the same time. So Zazen doesn't cure us of being a human body-mind. It doesn't cure us of suffering in the sense of illness or old age. When Buddha was real old, when he was 80, his favorite disciple said, "Buddha, you don't look very good anymore." He said, "You used to be all golden and beautiful and shiny," and said, you look all shriveled up." And Buddha said, "Well, of course, I told you, everything falls apart." Buddhas fall apart too. But we forget that. So that's one advantage of doing this practice and doing it in this way, that we come face to face with our mortality. And as a result, also face to face with our opportunity, that if we're going to do something, this is the time. This is it. Because we don't know. Koban said, "The whole body is one intuition, an intuitive understanding. You find the safest spot from which you see every direction." the intuitive understanding is not the one that's figuring everything out and is the mind that we usually bring with us, the mind that's always shoring up our defenses and creating some kind of survival situation so that we can get through. And yet, it's not enough. That kind of mind, that brilliant mind, that well-trained mind that most of us have, all of us have, brilliant as it isn't enough. And we find as we try to depend on it that it's not dependable. On the other hand, what Coben calls intuition is that sort of blind not knowing, or the what is called sometimes the one who is not busy. As we're carried, our thinking gets us only so far, and it's very thin, very, very thin little bit. And intuition is partial also. We'll never really know. But the most we can know is what we, in our depth, are found by and find. A kind of knowledge that we call wisdom. Our wisdom we can depend on, even though we don't know. So the best solution often when there's a real dilemma is just to sit down in not knowing and to sit for as long as it takes to meet our true wisdom, which even in the dark shines a little light. Uchiyama Roshi said, thoughts are merely scenery. Thoughts are merely scenery. They're always going, 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 all the time. And all the while that the thinking is going on, we're missing what's happening. But our intuition senses what's happening just where we are in place. And that we can depend on. So the first few days of sitting, as Coben said, it's like going into a huge warehouse where you find all the pots and pans and wrecked cars and ghost-like people, he said. Everything that's happened to us is still sort of present for us in some kind of distorted way because we don't remember correctly, accurately, I mean. We can't. Our memory is constantly changing. Every time we get an input, it switches things around. And we manage to switch it around so that we look better. That's part of our process as a self, to create ourself. We polish up our image. And of course, if we're the kind of self that puts herself down, then that is creating and remembering all those embarrassing times. But that's still creating an image, creating a self. And all the while, the present self is full of life, just as it is, with the scenery going by of what I used to be, what he said and what she said and what I wish I said and all those things. So Zazen is an opportunity to get very familiar with all of that. And it gets tiresome after a while, which is a good thing. You know, the more tiresome it is, Chogyam Trungpa said, the more bored you get, the better off you are. You're really getting there, he said. So, just let it be what it wants to be. Our thinking is usually driving us forward. But we can just let it have a rest for a little while. So I think that's enough. Are there questions and comments?
I guess this is a very surprising image, but maybe you can open it up a little bit. When it's hot, be an oven.
When it's hot, be hot. And when it's cold, be cold. Otherwise, you're just making up a story. So, yeah, that's an old koan. But of course, it doesn't mean that you don't take care of yourself. I mean, you don't wear full okesa when it's 100 degrees outside. At least I don't. And if you want to get your hair wet and cool yourself down that way, of course. You know, there are lots of ways of getting cool. But in terms of how we live, we accept how things are. And unless we accept it, we don't know what to do. What we do is always a little off because we're imposing our own idea on what's happening. So that's really what that's about. Let whatever's happening be and then deal with it. Don't rage against it. Oh, darn, it's so hot. I wish it would cool off. Blah, blah, blah. Because it doesn't do any good.
Talking about intuition and how that's that thin phase that responds to life too, yet it's not giving us everything from the picture. And I'm wondering if there's that part of intuition, our ability to respond that comes from a long time ago, like ancestors, is that the lineage that we receive?
That's a big part of it. We think of ourselves as this little person right here, right now, like we're all by ourselves in some way, but we are our ancestors. And if we've embraced the Buddha way, then we also are part of a lineage that goes far back, farther than Buddha even. So Our life is much bigger than we think it is, much deeper. And it also goes into the future. The future rides with us. so that it's a kind of it's all interconnected, completely interconnected. Yes. There's no goal. There's no goal. It's weird, isn't it? There's a lot of talk about enlightenment, but not very much in Soto Zen, because the talk of it is so distracting from the moment itself, which is what you're looking for. What we're looking for, we're already there. And so if it's presented as something that's coming next, or that's out there if we just work real hard, or if we're good, or all of those things that we try to polish ourselves up so we can be more perfect, and then we'll get somewhere, we'll get an A, we'll pass the exam, we'll get a chocolate ice cream cone or something. And none of those things, they're all out there. So what we're seeking is where we already are. And we fail to see it often because we're so self-involved. Self-involved and self-conscious. So as we sit, we begin to see that that's the truth of it. We begin to see how the thoughts are just going round and round and round. And at the same time, here we are. Then you begin to ask, what is this? What is this? And that's the essential question. But there's no goal. You can say it's about self-knowledge. Studying the self, as Dogen says, in order to forget the self. Not to be tied down by this busy thing that keeps trying to make itself into something important. To make itself safe is really based on fear. And it's a fear that's not so necessary. Some of our fears are very necessary to survive. But the fear of losing the self, of losing our identification, is a mistake. There's nothing to lose. So when we talk about getting rid of the ego, it's a joke, because there isn't any ego. There's somebody. Buddha was somebody also. But it's a somebody that changes continually, even as it maintains some sort of organization, so that we can say you are you and I am I. But you're not who you were when you were 2 years old, and neither am I. So we are continually changing until our death day, and then we begin to truly fall apart. So none of it is stable. And our mind tries to create a stability that is an artifice. And we think, it feels like if we don't have that stability, that we'll be a little crazy. Who am I if I don't have that self that I take care of? But if you spend deep time with yourself, you begin to understand that what you think of as yourself is very, very partial, and that there's much more. and that you are safe wherever you are, whatever happens. So in our practice, we create a safe space like this. And one reason for the silence is that we can help maintain that feeling of safety. And the more we know each other, the more we develop trust, the more we're able to sit in some kind of ease and develop the knowledge, the self-knowledge that we all are seeking in the middle of ourself. Okay? Sort of. It's everybody's question. No goal.